Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. I'm Eric Olson. It is time once again for America's Most Haunted, and we are heading off in a fascinating direction, exploring science channels, alien encounters with Dr. Hakeem Olusei. And I have to admit, guessing on the pronunciation. I was hoping he would check in before so that we could confirm it. But I gave it my all, and we'll see how that comes out when the good doctor joins us. How would humans react to an alien race arriving on Earth? What would be the impact of human contact with aliens? With 74% of Americans believing in the existence of aliens and 15 million believing they've actually made contact with extraterrestrials, many people have burning questions about life beyond Earth and its impact on humans. Season 3 of Alien Encounters, which airs, in fact, right now, I think this is the first time we've ever done this, where we were talking to someone from a TV show while it was literally airing. And I think this is the final episode of this season right now. It may be the second to last. We'll get a confirmation on that as well. Anyway, it's airing on Science Channel right now, 10 o'clock Eastern and Pacific on the Science Channel. And it's been raising hypothetical questions about and exploring the potential impact of alien contact with humans. And I kind of entered watching the show with a little bit of trepidation, not sure how it was going to go. But, man, I'm telling you, it is fascinating stuff, the way they are blending a storyline, and it's quite a plausible storyline, with all kinds of scientific input, including from our guest, star of the show, commentator on the show, Dr. Hakeem. And you got to help me with the last name. Is it Olusei?
It's Olusei.
I was close. Very close.
Yes. The trick is that the S is pronounced like an SH. Yeah.
Got it. Well, I got everything but the SH. And that was just a guess. What an impressive fellow you are, I must say, going through your whole biography. Man, oh, man, oh, man. You are astrophysicist to the stars, so to speak.
That's right. That's right. I'm a star hacker. I use stars to find out other things about the universe and how matter and energy and fields behave and interact.
It's amazing stuff. And, of course, you're not only one of the commentators, the expert commentators on Alien Encounters, which really is a very impressive show. It's kind of a interesting, original. It's an original combination. I see some Matrix in there. I see some Falling Skies in there. But it's put together in a very original and seemingly, to me anyway, from the outside, scientifically very rigorous fashion. It's really, really quite impressive. But before we do that, to my astonishment and amazement, have we been joined by the world-famous haunted housewife, Teresa Argy?
That's right, and I'm just glad that you did the introduction for the doctor and not me, because I would have not come anywhere near the correct pronunciation. Hello, doctor. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I got to tell you, my daughter, who is 12, going into eighth grade, what would you call yourself, Karen? An astronomy geek, future astrophysicist, star nerd, I don't know. I got many names for her, but she's a little upset. I'm shooing her away to go practice her violin. She wants to listen in on the show tonight because she is fascinated with the entire topic.
All right. Well, you know, it's really interesting stuff, and the way we do it on Alien Encounters is completely original. So she's in for a treat.
Excellent. Well, definitely, she watches all those shows. She absolutely loves them. More so than mine. She doesn't really listen to our show, but she'll listen to this one.
Well, we're kind of covering two topics. We should also mention that besides, of course, Alien Encounters, you are also star of Outrageous Acts of Science, which is really funny and interesting in its own right. And you appear hither and yon everywhere. So we're really talking about two things. We're talking about the show. We're talking about Alien Encounters because that's the focus of it. But, man, we're also talking about you and your career. It is fascinating. Yeah. It is inspirational. And, you know, if anyone is a source to people throughout the entire socioeconomic spectrum, of what can be achieved. I mean, you are it. You're really a very important and amazing individual. Why don't we start with you a little bit and just give us some of your background. Just tell us how you got to be where you are now. I don't want to take any of the thunder away from you. Just give us your tale.
Well, let's not make the listeners cry, but I'll just start off. I think you're right, right? I think my life does show what you can achieve and what a great opportunity we have in America. Neither one of my parents graduated high school. My father actually dropped out of school when he was 9 years old to work on the family farm in Mississippi. My mother, you know, she dropped out of school after her sophomore year of high school. And, you know, I grew up in some of the very challenging neighborhoods around America. And, you know, I had an interesting upbringing. My parents divorced when I was very young, 4 years old, and then we moved every year. I never went to school in the same state 2 years in a row, and it was always what you'd call a bad neighborhood with a horrible school, right? Inner city community in Los Angeles, New Orleans, Houston. And then finally, my mother at the age of 13, you know, she saw the handwriting on the wall, and she said, let me get this kid out of the inner cities where he's going to get in a lot of trouble because, frankly, I was attracted to trouble, and trouble was attracted to me, and she moved us to rural Mississippi. And that was one of the best choices anyone made on my behalf, you know, directly out of high school. I went into the military. I never even heard of calculus when I was in high school. You know, I had a poor high school education. I'll tell you how bad it was. In around the year 2000, Mississippi evaluated all of its schools, and every school was given a ranking from 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst score possible. Only 4 schools in the state scored that worst score possible, and 2 of them were my junior high school and my high school. So given that Mississippi is typically 50th in education in America, you know, I was truly at the number one worst school in America. And
that
what
is
happened,
kind
though,
of amazing to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really amazing. But you know, I was always attracted to science. You know, I was really attracted to Jacques Cousteau, who was on television. I was really attracted to Marley Safer, who was on television with Wild America. And then, you know, I would read a lot. My mother was a reader, and I'd read encyclopedias. That's what we had at home, the World Book Encyclopedia. And I discovered Albert Einstein when I was like 10, 11 years old, you know. And literally, I read the encyclopedias from A to Z. And when I discovered Einstein and relativity, I really fell in love with physics. I didn't know that it was a career option. You know, I just thought, you know, this is what when you already have a lot of money, what you do in your spare time sort of a thing. And so after the Navy, I went to college, and I went to a small historically black college in Mississippi, Tougaloo College. It's still small. It's still historically black. And I was able to get involved in summer research programs and found myself at Stanford University for graduate school. And as they say, the rest is history. You know, I went there. I was like a fish out of water, but I worked really, really hard, suffered through a lot. But, you know, I made it. And I basically, when I got into that world, I thought to myself, oh, my goodness, you know, these people here know nothing about the world that I'm from. The people where I'm from know nothing about this world. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to tell everybody. we're going to bridge these worlds. So, you know, I spend a lot of time trying to help people to transform their lives through education in the same way that I did.
It's kind of amazing that you, well, A, that you were this flower that blossomed out of literally the worst junior high and high school, more or less anyway, in the nation. I mean, that is really saying something if you think about it. And that you were able to make this just enormous leap. And then having done so, you are rooted enough, strong enough, secure enough, I guess, that you are able to function so well with a foot in each world. You know, a lot of people, of the people who do, and I absolutely am not going to name any names, but, you know, I'm interested in science. I'm very interested. Yeah. I was never particularly good at doing science, but I'm very, very interested in the concepts of science. And I've kind of always tried to keep up with it. And physics is probably my favorite just because it's so weird, you know, and cosmology.
Exactly.
And I mean, it's just so odd. How can reality be so counterintuitive? But a lot of the people who do make it, and certainly not just in science, but in any world, any sub-world, the people who make it, a lot of them, they don't want to go back. They just don't want to deal with it. It's too much of a, I don't know if it's a psychological thing, an emotional thing, or they just don't want to be bothered. But the fact is you are very, very well known for doing what you just said, and that is really going out of your way you know, to make sure people know about your background and have them see, hey, look, I made it. Look at what I do. Look at all these words you maybe can't even spell that are attached to my name, but I was like you. And that
That's
really
right.
is amazing. And I know Teresa really appreciates things like that too. Don't you, Teresa?
Absolutely. Hearing your story, Doctor, it makes me think, as a mother with two young children and one grown adult child, these schools that you came from, this upbringing that you had, obviously you must have an appreciation for the importance of education. And I was wondering if maybe possibly since you have this newfound success with these two shows and you're really well known, have you made a venture to go back to any of these schools, these inner city schools, and maybe see if you can get some of these science programs back on track or get these kids interested?
Well, you know, in fact, that's been a major effort on my part. Ever since I was a graduate student, I invest a lot of time and energy into doing exactly that in the United States and around the world. You know, I'm probably Africa's most famous scientist, and I'm not even an African, right? My name is African, and so they think I am. So, you know, every month I get emails from students in Africa and other countries, and they say, oh, you know, Professor, I love physics. Could you please mentor me? And I do what I can. You know, I'm very busy, right? And so, you know, there are young people right now I can think of in Tunisia and Algeria and South Africa and Kenya and Nigeria that I maintain an ongoing contact with, you know, and help them as they learn. It's you know, I feel that, you know, what was key in my case is there were times where people showed up and said, for example, hey, there's this thing called a science fair. You should participate. And so it was almost as if people showed up at key moments, as if they were placed there, as if they were supposed to be there. And so I feel I owe it to pay it back. Right, I should show up. It's the least that I can do, and I do. And you know, and let me tell you, there is no reward that you're given for doing so, other than you know what you yourself value. Your colleagues will tell you that you're wasting your time. You know, think of it as a very popular sports hero starts doing movies or making records. Right, their colleagues are going to look at them as if they're you know, not focused or wasting time. And you know, when you do a science is incredibly competitive, research science. There are fewer professional astronomers than there are, you know, professional athletes. It's very competitive, and you must be very focused and very hardworking to even survive in the field. And so to say that I'm going to spend my time, you know, I literally go into schools and work with students every single year, year in, year out, in America, in other countries, and I try to find, you know, those diamonds that are there in these tough circumstances and help them to meet their potential.
That's really excellent. I applaud you for that. That's great. Again, I'm lucky. My daughter is very intelligent. She's had this desire since she was probably one or two. First grade or second grade. She's really, really smart, and she's on the right track. She's in a public school system, but they encourage this. They're working with the STEM program and the STEM2M, and now there's a STREAM program they're introducing.
Yep.
So she's lucky, but I grew up in Cleveland. I grew up in the city, and the schools that were in my neighborhood are failing miserably. I mean, these kids, let alone are they not doing science, they can barely read. It's very, very sad.
Right.
So, and I know my daughter just wrote this big paper about how to encourage more funding for NASA and getting the younger generation interested in science. And it's because of shows, Outrageous Acts of Science. Thank goodness
yeah.
I shoot her up in her room. Before you said that, she would not have left. It's her favorite show. Love this show.
Wonderful.
And Cosmos, Through the Wormhole,
yeah.
all those shows, even Ancient Aliens, Alien Encounters, any
yeah.
of that. She loves all of that. And I'm so glad that they're exposed to that. So
yeah.
kudos to you. I really appreciate
Thank
that.
Thank you so much. I really
and,
appreciate
it. And I hope it pays
it.
Off in the future.
Well, while we're tooting that horn of yours, which is very large and well-tooted and needs to be regularly, let's just let people know then. You went from Stanford. I know you went
yeah.
into, just having read your biography, you went into the private sector and did some
That's
amazing
right.
things there before you
yeah.
went on. So why don't you just kind of flesh out the rest of your tale. Oh, but before I forget,
right.
I wanted to ask
yeah.
one other thing or just insert.
Yeah.
Can off the top of your mind, can you think of something just to kind of give people a sense of the culture shock? Can you think of something that happened or some interaction or just some realization with you at Stanford where you said, holy
oh
cow, I'm not in Kansas anymore?
Oh, I have a great story for you. So, look, I grew up when I moved to Mississippi, I lived in the country. I literally lived on a dirt road, off a dirt road, off a dirt road. And my dad, all of my parents had split up. My dad was around, and we interacted, and he was a hunting, fishing, farming kind of a guy. And so we ate everything in the forest, pretty much. So I show up at Stanford, and this is the first week of classes. And, you know, when you go to class, before the professor begins the lecture, there's the murmur of students talking. Now, I have this loud, heavy, deep voice, and so my voice carries through a room. So I turn to this guy. You know, the Stanford campus is very wooded, right? It's a lot of trees. So I turn to this guy, and I say, hey, man, you see all these squirrels on campus? And he goes, yeah. And I say, how come nobody eats them? the room fell silent, and everybody looks at me.
Oh no, they're protected. This is California.
Yeah.
This is Northern California. They're protected. Yeah. Oh, that's so.
Oh,
funny.
They're protected.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't realize that because had one strayed into my kitchen.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, you could just – I can imagine. I mean, I can't really imagine, and that's why I can imagine, because it is so crazy. All right. So you get your – did you go straight through and get your doctorate, or did you do the – did you work in between?
Well, no, I went straight through, but, I tell you, where I went to undergraduate, it was a small school in Mississippi, so I actually had to do 2 years of undergraduate courses, and then I did my PhD work, you do your academic work, and so what we did is that you see these pretty pictures of the sun with all these plasma loops and all these pyrotechnics going off. Our research group, led by the late Professor Art Walker, we were the first to do that. We actually flew rockets at White Sands Missile Range and pioneered that technology that now is you see images from it every day. My PhD advisor, by the way, he was also Sally Ride's PhD advisor. It's a gentleman
oh, wow.
named Art Walker, a fascinating gentleman, another in African American. What happened next is, I had come to the Silicon Valley where Stanford is, and I saw this whole other world that I didn't know anything about. So instead of going directly into, astrophysics research, I decided to go into the Silicon Valley. And I go into the Silicon Valley, and very quickly I'm able to really revolutionize a couple of fields. And I get 8 patent applications filed, 7 of which have actually been granted here in the U.S., 4 in the EU. A new division of the company is founded on several of the patents that I led the invention for. And so that was incredibly successful. But I still was unfulfilled. And one of the things I can say about that era, I worked for the company that dominates the market in making the tools that make computer chips. So very literally, you probably use technologies that I invented or helped to invent every day, right? Anything that you use that has a computer chip in it probably has some of my work represented in it. But I was dissatisfied. I was not receiving the intellectual fulfillment that I needed, even though it was fascinating work. And I was not getting the human, fulfillment that I wanted, right? I wanted to help other people. So I returned to academic research, and I worked with the Supernova Cosmology Project. And, of course, the leader, Saul Perlmutter, won the Nobel Prize in 2011 for discovering dark energy. And at the time, I was helping to build a satellite, a proposed satellite called SNAP. That's now, you know, the new satellite has the name WFIRST, and it's the highest priority space-based observatory. I'm not the leader. I was working on the focal plane technologies, the detectors. And then I decided to go to become a faculty member, and I went to Northern Alabama, and I was 50% paid by NASA, Marshall Space Flight Center, and 50% by the university. And what happened at that time, things were very successful, but I was always a big sports guy. I enjoyed playing sports, and I suffered this massive injury to my back. And it really led to 3 years of non-productivity in science. And I kind of poured myself into helping others as I had to deal with this. But then I came to Florida Tech, and now everything's, you know, going very well. My graduate student and I just submitted a patent application for a new in-space propulsion technique. I'm working with Mae Jemison and the 100-Year Starship Project, which is a mission in 100 years from now to send humans to the next star system. I have research collaborators everywhere, and in January I'll be starting at MIT as a faculty fellow. So things are going well.
I guess they are. Man, it's just such a bewildering assortment of amazing things, most of which I can only sort of conceptualize. When did you make the, not transition necessarily, but when did you add the kind of public intellectual and start doing the TV? And I know you do lots of live appearances,
yeah,
too. How did all that come about?
It was really a big accident, you know. I was sort of like this underground science star, you know, and people, you know, it really started when I was working for the Supernova Cosmology Project, or really at Stanford, right? I was teaching classes, and, you know, the word start went around that if you take Hakeem's class, so in college, even if you're not a science major, the university makes you take a science class or two, right? And so the students figured out that, hey, you know, if I take Hakeem's astronomy class, I'll be able to get an A. And they thought that I was grading easily, but the truth was is that as a graduate student, I did not grade at all. The professor did. But what happened is that they actually did better. And so people, for some reason, could understand me and get these very complex topics and feel like they could really understand it and do well. And they actually did. And so what happened is that when I went to Berkeley, people would often request Saul Perlmutter for a talk, right? But he wouldn't be available. So the lab people knew that I was really good at communicating science, so they'd send me out. And I started to become really popular. And then I began working, people would say, oh, come talk to students here, just because of my background, right? They'd say, oh, you know, we're in Oakland in a tough environment. Come talk to our students. And I never set out to be a motivational speaker or anything like this. I just literally love what I do, and I love science. And I'd go and I'd talk, and not only would the students, you know, vibe with me, but then they would always feel like they could do it. And, you know, it would spread to adults. And so ultimately what happened is the Science Channel asked me to be on their scientific advisory board, right? So there I was with Michio Kaku and Brian Greene, these you know, well-known names. And the lady, her name was Debbie Myers, who ran Science Channel at the time, she asked me about my research. And I explained it to her. And after this conversation, she says, oh, my God, I must put you on TV. And the rest and the rest followed from there. You know, it was not anything I set out to do. It sort of came to me, and so I did one show, and the next thing I know, all the science TV producers are just filling my email box asking me to be in their shows. And, you know, it really came to fruition last year. And so, you know, now I have to change the way I do things a little bit, because I would always say yes, because I'm always eager to help. But now there's just so much.
That's always the problem, isn't it? You know, you're struggling, or not even when you're struggling, but you're aspiring. That's what it is. You're aspiring,
yes,
and you're casting your net ever wider. You know, when you were talking, I was thinking, he sounds like a science virus spreading everywhere.
Wow.
You may use that, by the way.
I like that. That's what I'm going to take that. Thank
virus.
You.
Yeah, no problem. You don't even have to give me credit. So,
right.
You know, kind of the next step, I mean, obviously, logically, is mass media, of course. You know, there you're talking instead of one-on-one, although I think most people find that they're most successful on the media, whether it be TV or radio, broadcast media, by kind of pretending that you are talking to one person. And I think the most successful communicators do give people the sense, viewers or listeners the
right.
sense, that you are talking directly to them. But, you know, that again, that's the issue. You kind of found your natural level. You kept rising, and your science virus kept spreading, and now all of a sudden you reach this level of mass exposure, and now you have to start picking and choosing, you know, because
right.
I'm
yeah.
sorry, you're too successful. Teresa, what do you think about all this?
Oh, no, I agree. I mean, you've got a lot of balls in the air. It's a good thing you can juggle them properly. But I think it all comes down to you being a good communicator and being a good teacher. And I tell you, the value of a good teacher to inspire students to go forward. And you went from being a teacher, a scientist, a teacher, and now you're on television. Basically, you have a whole world of students now that you are teaching to. And
wow.
it's being able to do that in a charismatic way that gets people interested in science. I tell you, my daughter's interests are not normally the same as mine, but when I watch some of these shows with her, it makes it sound interesting. For somebody who's maybe not interested in the topic, if it's presented in such a way, you can really inspire them to want to learn more. I am fascinated with physics and space, things that I was never really good at in school, because to me it's almost like magic, and I know it's not, but when I look at something, it seems almost magical to me because my understanding of it is so low. But to watch something like that and it goes by how well you present it. I think it's great. I think it's a great service to get people involved because, I tell you, with the program that we have now, it's really very sad. I mean, some of the
yeah.
shows are really just so dumbed down for American audiences. It's
yeah.
nice to see something that challenges you in a fun way intellectually.
You know what? I'll tell you another story that really hits to how those values are set. You might remember not long ago there was the big announcement of discovering the Higgs boson. Do you remember that?
Oh, sure.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah, at CERN. Well, what happened is that the very first announcement of all the Higgs boson discoveries was really not really the conclusive measurement. It was the discovery of a Higgs-like boson, right? And it wasn't until we made a measurement of a quantity called the spin that it was really confirmed to be the Higgs. And what happened is that I was actually flown to New York to show up on to the Today Show to explain this to the American public. And I got bumped. And you know what bumped me? Do you remember when that cruise liner lost power and all the people were stuck out there with no bathrooms and such?
Yes.
Yes.
In the Caribbean.
Well, it was not,
or off the Caribbean.
That's right. It was not that particular episode. It was the one that happened later when they were still in the port and no one was on the ship and the ship lost power. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
Yeah, that story is what bumped the Higgs boson discovery, which was for the first time, here it is, we've used this word mass, right? You know, particles have mass. What's the mass of the proton? What's the mass of the oxygen atom, right? And we did not really know what the origin of mass was. And now here for the first time, we understand the origin of mass. And that gets bumped because a cruise liner lost power while in port.
Look, we're talking about American commercial network TV, so nothing is terribly shocking, you know, what can you, on the other hand, look, look at the series that just ran on American commercial network TV, the Cosmos series. That, you know, we should give credit where credit is due. I thought that was, you know, in general, quite well done and not terribly dumbed down. I mean, I don't know that they completely, you know, addressed everything from in the most scientific terms, but I think they did try to at least address things from a conceptual and to tell those stories. And, yeah, I mean, it was well done. Teresa covered it. She was in on the interview with the who did you
Neil
interview?
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh, you did?
Neil
you did talk to
Tyson
Neil. That's right.
In,
yeah, of course.
Denver, yeah.
As I understand the Higgs. Oh, go ahead.
Yes, no, I was saying that there is a lot of good trends right now. If you look at the public, the public is really interested in scientific stuff. You know, we have a lot of now scientific celebrities, per se, because people are so interested. And I think that's what's really, you know, that makes me so optimistic is that, you know, people ask for it, people are paying for it, and, you know, there's a new generation of kids for which being a nerd is cool. You know, it's no longer like it was. So I think that, you know, there is a resiliency to the human spirit, and the human mind is just so curious. And, you know, we're always going to have these scientific pioneers. So, you know, we could do better. But really, you know, we're doing it. It's happening.
You're right. I mean, to look at the big picture, this really is an amazing time that we live in because it's a combination of things. I think interest in science is at least somewhat tied to developments in science. And my God, look at all the things that have happened just in the last 5-10 years. It's just astonishing, all of these developments.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we really are in a time. You know, I don't know what would be comparable, you know, maybe back to Einstein. I'm not sure,
right.
You know, or the Manhattan Project or, you know, something just with real quantum, no pun intended, quantum leaps, you know, in our knowledge. And just to make sure I understand, just because I'm trying to be better at all this and to kind of pound it into my brain, which I wish I'd have done a better job of when I was back in school. As far as the Higgs goes, as I understand it, what it is it's kind of a field, and it's a field that particles pass through, and as they pass through it, that's what gives them the mass. Is that close?
That's essentially it, right? But this field is very special. And if you consider all of the fields that we are aware of. So what I like to ask my students of physics is a very simple question, and that is, what exists? Because if we're going to do cosmology and we're going to say here's how the universe came into existence, we need to know first what exists and how do these things come into existence. And so it's a very short list. There's matter, there's fields, there's space, time, and energy. And the thing about the fields that we're aware of, generally, they all have their source with matter, right, or other fields. So the electric field, the magnetic field, the gravitational field, they have sources that generate these fields. The Higgs field, on the other hand, is a field that permeates all of space, and it doesn't really have a source in the same way that the other fields do. And so everything you said is correct, right? So particles coupled to these fields, and we're talking about the elementary particles, the smallest particles, because once you start getting into the particles, the masses of, you know, atoms and nuclei, there are other mechanisms that have to do with their interactions, which account for most of their mass, and so it's way more complicated than we want to get into, but at the most elementary level, that's how masses are generated. And so this is this resistance to an acceleration that every matter particle feels.
Got it. And what's going on right now, I guess, again, just as I understand it, is because of these recent discoveries or in conjunction with those, they're now various competing theories that there may be more than one kind of Higgs boson?
Yes. So there were always ideas of there being more than one type of Higgs boson. And so there are Higgs You're trying to make this conversation really complicated. There.
But you're the science virus guy.
I got to use these crazy words like electro weak. If I say the electro weak Higgs and these sort of things, right? But this particular Higgs is the Higgs associated with conferring mass to the particles.
Got it, and we'll leave it there because it's time to move on to alien counters.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
As I was saying at the beginning of the show, I'm actually very impressed at the sophistication of the show, and I would imagine you wouldn't be involved if it wasn't that. So why don't you give people, give listeners a sense of, an overview of the show and then how you got involved and where we're going with it.
So the show is set up off of a hypothetical situation where aliens come to Earth. But the thing about this show is that it's not your typical view of aliens coming to Earth, right? They don't show up in some ship and they're green men. What this show does that I think is just brilliant in its creativity is that it weaves in the future of Earth in a way, right? So all these advanced technologies that we've yet to really take advantage of are highlighted in this show, and they're shown in terms of their potential. Things like quantum computing, things like the advantages that are taking place in material science right now, the so-called smart materials, the advances that are taking place in biology right now. And these advances in technologies and biology almost hit at advances in humans. And some of that is even shown in the show, right? We're going to better ourselves through our own cleverness, right? So what happens is that DNA from aliens gets mixed with DNA from humans, which has now generated a sort of new generation of superhumans. Some of the alien technology is mined from space as this technology orbits our planet, and that gives rise to new technologies. And then alien computational technology competes with human technology to take over the world. And so it's a story with many different layers.
I love the sociological aspect. I think that's it's much more nuanced than your typical or even beyond typical, even really particularly well done and well thought out kind of science fiction alien encounter type scenarios, in that it takes the time to show cultural aspects, the sociological aspects. And what I was thinking about, what I may like best about it, is it's very sophisticated in terms of whose side are you on. It's not just us versus them. There's kinds of gradations in there, and you have this whole, as you were saying, you have this whole new class of hybrids. So where are their loyalties, and where are our loyalties to them? Because they're still mostly human or half human. Yeah. I don't know exactly what they are. They look human.
And they are our children.
Exactly, and grandchildren, as is a really great line one of the recent episodes says. And I think that application, that's one of the things that is often missed in any kind of conflict or war type fiction, is it's very rarely black and white, us versus them.
Yeah.
There's always these gradations, even in our most, kind of iconic conflicts like the Revolutionary War or even the Civil War. There are people who are conflicted.
And what's really interesting about this one is that these deep meanings and these deeper ideas, whether they be the science, the sociology, what the show has done is brought in leading experts on each of these topics, right, to address the particular complication that is being shown on the show. And I think that this show has a complexity and a sophistication that typically you don't see in a television show. It's almost like a major movie in the plot.
It is. I, like I said, I really there's echoes of The Matrix, the trilogy, and some of the better, more sophisticated aspects, I think, of the thinking behind The Matrix. I do see some Falling Skies. You know, that hybrid thing, that's something that Falling Skies does very well. They show mixed loyalties as well, although theirs is much more of a classic invasion scenario. But, yeah, that's coming back just in a few days as well. And there's definitely some parallels there. But I agree, and I think the format where you have the dramatization aspect, which is well done, by the way. It looks, you know, if you're not always sure if I am in a dramatization segment – or is this a science guy telling me what's up here? So that's a good sign. But that really interesting going back and forth between kind of the story, the unveiling of the tale, and how what is happening within that, and then kind of commentary on that, riffing on that, and probably most importantly, I think, is pointing out the current or near future real term implications or applications of the various technology or the concepts being mentioned. So it's almost like, okay, here's a story. All right, now here's the real stuff on it. Now here's more story. Now here's more real stuff on it. And I think that works really well. I really haven't had the sense of the story being particularly interrupted. I think the pacing and the editing is really quite good. And I like the use of a lot of different experts and people who do have somewhat, you know, varying perspectives on things. Teresa, what do you think? Have you had a chance to check it out?
Just briefly, just the bits and pieces of it. Besides the show, and the show is fascinating, the different topics that you dwell into are really interesting. But outside of the show, on a personal note, what is your opinion of aliens and life out there in space? Are we alone in this universe? Are there lots of different Earths out there? Is there just one? What is your scientific opinion on that?
Well, you know, I think that finding life off of Earth elsewhere in the universe is today pretty much where finding planets was in around the 1980s. So we have understood star formation for many, many decades, you know, approaching 100 years now. And one of the things that was realized pretty quickly is that planets are more than likely made from the leftover stuff from when stars are born. And that means that virtually every star should have a planetary system. Heck, even if we look around our solar system, even planets have things orbiting them. Even asteroids have little satellites orbiting them. So certainly stars, virtually 100% of them are going to have planets orbiting them. But the real question was, can we find them? And it wasn't until the 1990s that we started finding them, and now finding them is routine. And I think that right now we're on the eve of when we're going to find life elsewhere in the universe. Not necessarily, it might be in our solar system or out of our solar system. It just depends on how hard we look and how quickly technology advances. Here's the key, right? We know that everywhere in the universe is made of the same stuff. We see that the physics that takes place everywhere in the universe is the same. The chemistry that takes place everywhere is the same. And, you know, carbon is a very, it's an atom that can create many, many different molecules, you know, carbon chemistry. And life is essentially carbon chemistry in the presence of water. And water is probably the most abundant molecule in the universe. There's hydrogen everywhere. There's oxygen everywhere. We find building blocks of life throughout the galaxy in our spectroscopic studies, right? We find amino acids and complex hydrocarbons. So I think that it's just a matter of time. We're on the eve of when we find life elsewhere. And once we find it, we're going to start finding it everywhere.
What do you think the social impact of that is going to be once when it's confirmed that there is life in any form, be it microscopic or plant or any kind of form, not just like human life, but what do you think the impact is going to be on this culture? Because I think people are going to be terrified, honestly. I think that there are so many people that are ignorant to other things outside their small bubble of the world. I think that people are going to be terrified.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. There are going to be people that are going to celebrate it. There are people that are going to be terrified of it. But here's the thing about people. We are adaptable. That's why we're so successful. And so the generation that discovers it is going to find it to be amazing and new, but very quickly they're going to be replaced by a generation of humans for whom this is normal. This is the way it always has been. Right. I remember, you know, I told my son about, you know, oh, yeah, when the Internet came out, it was popular. He's like, what? You were born before the Internet? Oh, my God. You know? But, yeah.
I think I was born before electric toothbrushes.
Oh, man. Well, you know, electric toothbrush technology has really been updated a lot.
Yeah, it's sonic and stuff.
Now, I think that microscopic life is everywhere. And, you know, if you look at the universe as an ecosystem, then it's going to select for life of two types, I think. One type is extremely robust life, like the microorganisms, that can just survive the harsh environs of space. And these very simple life forms also have this amazing potential built in them, right? They can evolve to form ever more complex life forms and ultimately intelligent life like ourselves. And I think intelligent life is the other life form that the universe selects for, because planets are temporary. Stars are temporary. If you cannot leave your planet and survive out in space, ultimately you're going to go extinct. So the only two types of life forms that can survive this are the single-celled organisms that are just robust and they can survive it, or intelligent life forms that can decide for themselves their own fate. And, you know, allegedly, we are the latter, and we need to be getting ourselves ready to hedge our bets and, you know, diversify our planet portfolio and, get on some other planets before this one suffers a major catastrophe yet again, like we know it has, that wipes out, you know, most of the large life forms.
I think that part of the reason that people, at least not all people, obviously, but that many people might be resistant to this concept of intelligent life or life of any kind, again, on other planets, it comes back to not just cultural beliefs, but religious beliefs. Because that will, especially like for a Christian maybe, would really make them think, wow, everything that I've learned, everything I've dedicated my life to, my faith, my dogma, is now challenged by this notion. And I think that is that's a hindrance, I think, with science and even with the paranormal, that in the field that I work in, we see this a lot with the religious aspect coming up as a wall to any sort of further research and development. It really does stop you in its tracks at certain points. To me, because I view things differently on kind of on a grander scale. But what do you have any personal religious beliefs, or how has that affected you as a man of science? Can you also be a man of faith or a man of religion
by breaking things down
to the very molecule that they are?
Well, I guess here's the question that you know, what science is not very well understood. Right. But you know, we talk about it like it's this thing. Right. You know, I hear people use phrases like, well, you know, the Bible says this, but science says this, right? And one thing to recognize is that science doesn't say anything. Science listens, right? Science is the process by which we allow the universe to tell us what it is. Matter, tell me what you are. You know, life, tell me what you are. And so, you know, science is a process, but it's also a report. And a report is a report of that which has been observed to be true. So the question we really have is that when we observe the universe and it tells us, you know, we observe the Earth, and by you know, many means, we come to understand, oh, wow, the Earth is actually very old. It's 4.5 billion years old. Now, you find that this contradicts your religious belief and your interpretation of your religious text. what do you do? What is the choice that you make? Are you going to believe your lying eyes, or are you going to, you know, hold to that particular aspect of your religious faith that you think is what it's telling you? And so the way I look at it is the following. There's a very famous story from the history of astronomy, and it has to do with Galileo. Galileo was a professor in Italy, and he was teaching, Euclidean geometry, Aristotelian physics, and Ptolemaic cosmology, right? And he hears about this thing called a telescope. And so he builds one. And he doesn't just build a telescope. He builds the world's best telescope. It's small, but, you know, it's the best one there is on the planet. And what he does is he looks up at the objects in the heavens, and he finds that they're very different from what the church stated is the way things are. So he looks at the sun, and he sees that it has spots. It's not perfect, as was church doctrine at the time. And not only that, by the motion of the spots, he could tell that the sun was rotating. He looks at the moon, and he sees that it looks just like the earth does, right? It has mountains. It has what he thinks are seas, right? He looks at Jupiter, and he finds that, whoa, Jupiter, through my telescope, looks the way that the moon looked to my naked eye. So here it is. The moon is looking like the earth, and Jupiter is looking like the moon. So does that mean that the Jupiter is like earth, or even worse, that the earth is just another planet like Jupiter? And then he sees that there are these four little stars, he thinks, they're really moons, that are orbiting Jupiter. And at the time, you know, it was believed that only things could orbit the Earth because it was the center of the universe. And so he finds that all of the things that he sees through his telescope are in contradiction to what was the way people thought and what had become a part of church doctrine. So what does he do? He calls together the civil leaders. He calls together the religious leaders. And he has them look through his telescope so they can see these things himself. So they can say, oh, reality is different from what we think. And as they go and look, guess what they all say? They look at the moon, and they say, I don't see any mountains. They look at Jupiter, and they say, I don't see any four dots orbiting it. And that's what's happening today, right? Science is us scientists looking to see what is there, what reality is. And these other people are telling us, no, you don't see what you say you see. You don't see the earth warming and it's the result of what humans are doing, right? You don't see that the earth is old. You don't see that the universe started in this hot, dense state that we call the Big Bang. And here's the thing. I think that, you know, our forefathers of our country got it right. Everybody has a right to their own religious faith and belief, right? But the thing that we can't do is we can't have people saying that our scientific results are not valid because of their faith, right? There is a process in science by which invalid data and theories get moved to the side. But our scientific results are what is going to save our species from extinction. It is what's going to save our economy from collapse. And so, you know, we just can't afford that type of backward thinking right now.
Very well put. I like the analogy to that time. You know, it's hard to believe. I mean, on the one hand, 500 years ago sounds like a long time, but it's not very long at all. That literally most of mankind, virtually all of mankind, thought that the Earth was literally the center of the universe. And that doctrine so blinded people. I mean, it literally blinded them per the story you told. I mean, they were literally blinded. And the difference between then and now is things are moving so much more quickly now. So the consequences are potentially so much greater of ignoring, what appear to be facts on the ground, because things are so much quicker. The technology, the rise of technology, the rise of our communications abilities. And by the way, all of these things are addressed in Alien Encounters, by the way. You know, a big, a core, kind of a core kind of a, the spine, really, of the show, or a spine of the show, is the fact that this networking, which appears to be more or less instantaneous due to the quantum entanglement aspects of it and the quantum computer, you know, that that has created a new entity that is the combination of all of those connected entities. And the ramifications of that really are pretty astonishing. And we are at a point where it is more important than ever that we do address, or try our best anyway, to address the realities on the ground and to separate out the dogma. And in general, you know, science, people have a point when they say that science has doctrine, science has dogma, science has predispositions, science isn't perfect. Well, I don't think science thinks it is perfect, because science, whatever the current body of knowledge is, or of theory, I should say, because that's a key distinction, it changes all the time, and it does evolve. And it's not as though science is not constantly replacing outdated or disproved theories. And I think it's certainly that is its greatest strength.
Yeah, well, you know, what happens more often than not in science is that you have theories that are not, like, incorrect. You have theories that are incomplete. So, for example, Newton's laws of motion. A lot of people think that Einstein's work, you know, showed that Newton was wrong, right? Newton wasn't wrong, right? Force still equals mass times acceleration. Newton's gravity is still pretty accurate, and we use it. And it's only in certain, you know, cases that specific cases that we have to make these modifications due to Einstein's relativity. And so, you know, the thing about – here's a big difference between religious belief and scientific belief and scientific, you know, knowledge. If you look at religious belief, it's a very strong function of geography, right? You know, if you're in North America versus if you're in Saudi Arabia versus if you're in China or India, you'll find that people sort of think the same way in their religious thinking, a spiritual world, you know, what the spiritual world is, what's considered fact and knowledge. But if you look at the scientific knowledge, you know, E equals MC squared everywhere on planet Earth. There's nowhere where that deviates or differs, right? There is no belief in science. You don't accept things as being fact without actually knowing that they're fact, right? Because your colleagues are there, and it has to be proven to them, and they have to be able to reproduce it, right? So, you know, they just aren't the same thing at all, and they're not done the same way. You know, if you listen to the public discourse, you think that every 30, 40, 50 years, all the world scientists get together in a room, and we always have the meeting on the same topic, and that is, what is the lie we're all going to agree upon, right? And so the most recently it's been global warming. But, you know, the way science really works, when we work on something, you know, you will work on something for a year, 2 years, 3 years, even longer, and the way you present this information to your colleagues is either in publications or in person via scientific talks. And always their default response is skepticism. But here's the thing. They don't say it nicely. They're really mean, right? You've seen The Big Bang Theory, you know, the TV show. It's they literally will rip you a new one, and you will be absolutely 100% correct. And they will rip you a new one, and you really have to prove your case. And so when something makes it through this filter of hate, right, and that's the only thing, you know the word hater, right, what it means to be a hater?
Of course.
Yeah, scientists are trained to be haters. And not only that, you know, it goes to our personality, right? When I think of physicists, sometimes I think of them as the League of Valedictorians, right? It seems like everybody was a valedictorian. You know, everybody's been the smartest kid their entire life. And so now, among this group, one person is going to stand up and say, hey, look, I'm so smart. I figured out what you couldn't figure out. how do you think that's going to be received? You know, people have a gross misunderstanding of how this process works. You know.
Well, there's plenty of infighting, and there's even fraud, as we learn from time to time, because there is so much pressure, and because well, as you were saying at the beginning of the show, it's a narrow. You know, he said there are more professional athletes than there are professional astrophysicists or out there, astronomers probably even to broaden it out a bit. And so it is. It's very competitive. It's a very narrow world. There's all kinds of pressure from various directions regarding it. And I mean, it's the winnowing process. So by the time something does come to be generally accepted, it has been seriously vetted. Well, unbelievable that we have made it through. What a blisteringly quick hour. What a pleasure to talk with you. No question about where your popularity comes from, because you are both authoritative and commanding, but also extremely personable, really easy to talk
to. Thank you so much.
Super great guy. Really have enjoyed it. Teresa, what are your thoughts?
Oh, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I'm just glad there are people out there like yourself that can make these topics more accessible to the public and make it sound interesting, because I tell you, if left to our own devices, I think a lot of people would just veg out on Honey Boo Boo, and that is not going to do well for our future. So keep doing the work that you're doing. It's great. This is all good stuff. It's very interesting to talk to you, and my daughter will listening to this broadcast, so you have to say hello to Karen.
Hi, Karen.
There you go. Now she'll be happy. I had Neil deGrasse Tyson say she was going to be the first woman on Mars during my interview, so she's all thrilled. Got two astrophysicists.
Awesome.
Thank
Thank you guys so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Good luck with everything. We'll certainly be following what you're up to, and it's all really quite amazing and accomplished. And are they talking about another season of Alien Encounters? Is this continuing on?
I think they are. You know, the current season, the shows come on at 10 p.m. on Tuesday nights, and an episode just came on, so tune in next Tuesday. They reshow it. They reshow the episodes, so we have Alien Encounters. We have How the Universe Works is coming soon, and of course, Outrageous Acts of Science is on Saturday. So we have a great lineup.
You really do. We love Science Channel. We always have. And we always try to have guests on associated with any of the Science Channel shows. It's always informative, and they're usually quite entertaining as well. Science Channel seems to do a very good job of straddling that line between education and entertainment, making education entertaining, I suppose.
There you go.
Such as yourself.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, thanks a lot,
Eric. Hakeem. Have a great evening. Have a great week. Hope to talk to you again soon. We will certainly be following your career. Thanks, Teresa. It was very nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you,
Teresa. We haven't been on together for a while.
All right. It's been a pleasure, everyone. Have a good night. And check us out on Facebook. And you can follow the doctor on Twitter. Check him out. He's tweeting all night. All right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.